Welcome back to Zero Books and Repeater Media. This is Craig, the host of the Asset Horizon podcast, on a solo mission to rescue from the underworld one Andy Sharp, who is a writer and multimedia artist whom repeater readers will know from his book on repeater entitled The English Heretic Collection. Andy has a new book out on Watkins called The Astral Geographic, The Watkins Guide to the Occult World. It's a magical itinerary which takes you deep into the realms of alchemy, necromancy, psychogeography, and much more. And we definitely want to touch on the themes in that book at some point in our discussion today, but there is another pressing matter in focus, one which Andy and I take very seriously. And maybe it's best to highlight a question which we will probably tackle at the apex of this discussion, which is, are dreams anti-capitalist? Or maybe the better question is whether there's a real importance to our imagination, which is embodied in dreams, which can help us address the character of our collective fantasies and a world which, or an idea or a dream, which ultimately refuses continued oppression under existing forms of domination. But there's a lot of presuppositions lurking around this question, namely whether dreams are connected to the political world at all. Fortunately, Andy and I share an interest in a figure who's had much to say on this topic, and that is archetypal psychologist James Hillman. So Andy and I are going to talk about the work and legacy of Hillman and its implications for various aspects of the way we live our lives. And Andy, I just wanted to say thank you for your kind interactions via email and agreeing to sit down with me today.
Oh, no, it's a real pleasure. It's great. I think it's really good, as I said to you, that to see James Hillman being used in philosophical writing as well as psychology.
Yeah, absolutely. I encountered Hillman a long time ago. In fact, before many of the philosophical figures that are probably most interesting or I'm most involved with today, but I would say at this stage in my life, Hillman's made a sort of resurgence, and he has connections to a lot of figures in philosophy, like Gilles Deleuze, for example. I think there's a lot of strong overlap between his ideas. But I'm curious, how did you get into James Hillman? He's an American. You're living in the UK. How did he make his way over to the British Isles?
Yeah, so I first read about him many years ago in a countercultural magazine called Rapid Eye, which was all part of the kind of industrial subculture type thing. And it was like an English version of research publications. And they had an interview with Derek Jarman. And Derek Jarman, the filmmaker who's associated with COIL and Templar Psychic Youth, he mentioned him. And when I was, as a teenager, you were always using references and sort of voraciously feeding off any reference. So I started looking at his stuff probably when I was about 18, but to be honest, I wasn't sophisticated enough to understand some of the ideas there, and I hadn't read much Jung, so I think I needed to understand other things before I understood Hillman. So I came back to him about 10 years later, and it all made a lot more sense. And I think with Hillman, it's very important to read it at the right time. There's a kind of temporal sort of significance to his work because it's so layered and things like that, that different things chime. And it's such a broad, he writes on such a broad manner of topics that something will hit you at a particular time. And I was interested at that time, I was probably just sort of starting off English Heretic. So it provided a kind of backbone for a lot of the English Heretic concepts, albeit in a different idiom. So it made a lot of sense because I was actually looking at Neoplatonic occultism as well in a kind of modern light. And he also helped bridge a divide that I'd sort of made a connection between J.G. Ballard's work and some sort of post-Crowleyan occultism and concepts of like Clifforth and sort of deleterious sort of aspects of modern world, like, you know, atomic disaster and things like that. And Hillman really provided a bridge from kind of Freud and Jung, which very much is where Ballard stops, and into a kind of like an occult reading. So, and the weird thing is I've never ever seen Ballard reference Hillman, but there's so many ideas.
That's interesting. So how in your book, The English Heretic, for example, I mean, we see plenty of references directly to James Hillman in your new book, but how does Hillman factor into the work that you've done with imaginal documentaries?
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, it was very idiosyncratic. And it was the way I used it was as a learning exercise, essentially. So I'd be reading Hillman and taking on the ideas, kind of revisioning particularly, and seeing through and things like that. But I was applying it to a kind of a cultural lens. It was English Heretic was a lot of black humor, really. So these imaginal documentaries, as I like to think of them, were a way of creating this, these kind of almost Dali's idea of a paranoid critical theory, but applying it to documentary making. So you were looking at connections, but imagistic connections. So a good example was I did this piece called Mondo Paranoia that was a kind of subversion of the idea of, I did a lot of it was subversion of the idea of heritage history. So this was a kind of a pastiche of the Kennedy assassination. I looked at the kind of imagistic similarities or connections between Kennedy's death, C.S. Lewis's death. C.S. Lewis and Aldous Huxley all died on the same day. They all died on 22nd of November. So there was this weird connection. And then I used the kind of sort of Hillman-esque approach in order to tie these narratives together. So looking at imagistic correspondences, which is, it's not, oh, no, I'm not saying there's a factual truth, but there's a, while it's interesting, is an imaginal kind of story to be told. And so it's very creative and very speculative, and it is an imaginative story, but nevertheless, it's taking history and pop culture and our culture and putting it through the lens of Hillman's thinking, which is essentially following the images rather than kind of some sort of reductive analytical approach to a subject matter.
Yeah, let's dive into that a little bit. And I'm going to have to play fast and loose here just to get to the heart of our discussion, which is Hillman develops his theories out of the broader theory of analytical psychology of Carl Jung. And we could say about Carl Jung, oh, the overlap between Carl Jung and Hillman is manifold. But perhaps one of the strongest points of overlap is this concept of an archetype, where images in our fantasies, in our daydreams, and in our dreams at night have this archetypal character that bears an imprint of things that we see in ancient myth and folklore. And in analytical psychology, or at least in some of the ways that it's been treated, these myths then become a sort of paradigm or a rubric by which we determine the meanings of dreams. And then in a therapeutic context, we take these meanings and try to build up a broader edifice of meaning for our lives. That might be one way to do it. But Hillman is somewhat critical of this maneuver, primarily because, as you pointed out, Andy, there's a kind of reductive maneuver being made whenever we put the kind of stamp or imprint of a particular archetypal reading over any dream that we might have. Hillman has this idea of sticking to the image. And this is something that you alluded to, following the images. And also this distinction that you also alluded to, which is the distinction between factual reality and a quote-unquote imaginal reality. And so maybe we could unpack those ideas through the work that you've done, particularly, I mean, it really interests me that the idea, for example, that JFK, C.S. Lewis, and Aldous Huxley all died on the same day. What is the imaginal through line there? And take me through how you would use Hillman's techniques to articulate that relationship.
So I do a number of comparisons here. So I with the actual deaths, I compare their kind of various images associated with their death, because Huxley was given a huge dose of LSD as he was passing away, so intravenous injection, and he died blissfully in the arms of his second wife. And his second wife was saying, "I want you to go up in bliss to your first wife." And then I compare that almost imagistically, compared the Kennedy death, which is a gun to his head, which is a violent, an utterly violent demise in his wife's arms and things like that. So a look at the kind of almost the parallels in the process of their dying and things like that. So that's one example. But I take it quite, it fans out quite a bit. So I look at other correspondence. So C.S. Lewis's death, for instance, I look at Aslan, the lion that's sacrificed and things like that, and look at kind of this notion of the sacrifice of the king and things like that, which is again, like there was a sort of Ballardian reading there, because in Ballard's Miracles of Life, he alludes Kennedy's death to the death of the Corn King, which sort of reinvigorated the world. So he suggested we needed this sacrifice for the 60s. So look at sort of various aspects of C.S. Lewis's stories, but I bring in some quite sinister sort of connections here. So the day after Kennedy's assassination, the Moors murdered in England, killed their first victim and things like that. And there's this psychological thing saying, well, they were triggered by the Kennedy assassination. So look at various connections between their murder and this place called Underland, and it's Underland is in Narnia and things like that. And I look at the kind of the way that they visited the moors and buried these children in the moors, and relate it to this kind of Underland where the witch lives in C.S. Lewis's style. So it's parodic, really, but in a weird way, it isn't essentially parodic, because after 9/11, a couple of months after 9/11, James Hillman gave this speech in Tel Aviv about a kind of archetypal reading of 9/11 events, and it's easily as out there as anything I wrote. And he looks at the concept of the fall and three aspects of the fall in philosophical terms, in terms of like hubris and retribution and things like that. And then, but then he goes into kind of a wild sort of tangent where he looks at the astrology around the time of 9/11, and says the astrologers were concerned because there was this kind of meeting between Pluto and Saturn three times in a short spate over that period, and he alludes to various events like that. So that's, I can't remember whether I read that piece before I did the Mondo Paranoia, but there's striking similarities in the kind of audacity, if you like. So that's the kind of approach I did with. So it's connection, but it's, and I'm doing a lot of replacement of images, as I said, replace this image with this image, the syringe with the gun and things like that. So it's a surrealistic device, essentially, but it's also an imaginal device, really.
I think that's one of the really grand things that Hillman has bestowed to us here in the 21st century, maybe as opposed to the 20th century analytical psychologists, is the utter modularity of the imagination. And thinking about perhaps, for example, how people, individuals and societies and cultures with different imaginal constructs can link in and interact with one another and speak a kind of imaginal language. And you talk about James Hillman quite a bit in your new book, The Astral Geographic, which is a book, as we mentioned earlier, it covers alchemy, it covers psychogeography, necromancy, and the idea of active imagination comes up, and you give quite a nice explanation of that. And I think this is one thing I believe is essential to understanding Hillman and his method, is this use of active imagination. And prior to us pressing record here earlier today, you mentioned that you're a software engineer. I don't know if I can leave that in the recording or not.
Yeah,
but yeah. It's always curious to me to see someone, for example, who's in a technical trade like you, like, What sort of value, like, first of all, what is active imagination as you explain it in your new book? And do you find any personal or practical value in these methods in your own work?
Well, in my day work, no, not also.
Not at all.
I think we'll come back to this topic later about, because when you talk about irrationalism and things like that, and I have a reading on that, which I mentioned briefly in the book. But the active imagination is, it's kind of sensate conversation with the like a waking dream. So when I was about 18 or 19, I was interested in practical magic and also psychology. And obviously one of the techniques of practical magic is this concept of astral projection, where you project out your body and then have a conversation with the various spirits or various people who occur in your reality. Now, when I tried to do this in a conscious way, it felt very false. But then I started reading Jung's ideas of active imagination, where you basically involve yourself in a conversation with whoever comes to you in your visual sphere when you start meditating or thinking on a particular topic, but you treat them as real people. You don't treat them as fictions. You interact with them as if they're real people, and you interact with the landscape as if it's a real landscape, and you move through it and things like that. So Jung's idea of the active imagination is after a dream, rather than interpret the dream, you can use the active imagination to step back into the dream and investigate different areas of it and relationships as if it was a living entity. Now, I found that invaluable for writing fiction when I was younger. Obviously, I'm writing it as a hobby, really. But I found some very strange sort of sensations happening when I did that. Things like sort of prickling up the back of the neck, and the visual sphere became very, very vibrant. And then I suddenly realized this is actually very close to the landscapes that are described in astral projection. Now, I think they're kind of one and the same thing, really. And I think there's different terminology, but the actual process and the actual endeavor is to essentially have a sensate relationship with the dream world while you're waking. And so that's what active imagination is. And so Jung gives a bunch of things about active imagination, but Hillman takes active imagination a bit further and says this is not a process of achieving kind of blissful states. What it is a never-ending Ouroboros of know thyself with a pandemonium of images as if you were in a theater. So whereas the idea of meditative practice is shutting down the mind, in Hillman, he's actively saying we need to engage with kind of the gods through active imagination, but it's a kind of riotous, never-ending process, which is very close to alchemy in a sense, hermetic thinking.
When I first encountered this material, it was really in the wake of an imaginal crisis of sorts. I was living overseas, and people who are listening to this have probably heard this story maybe two or three times on other episodes, but I was living in Japan and I was a teacher, which is not an uncommon sort of thing for an expatriate to do. But during that time, and maybe somewhat as a function of the culture shock while living there, I started to experience night terrors. And prior to that, early in my life, maybe around the time I was 4 to 7 years old, I had pretty significant episodes of sleep paralysis. And just to connect, one thing that you mentioned earlier is that you talk about the hair standing up on the back of your neck. When I think about what life is like and how long life can actually be in a certain way of looking at things, it's very rare, I would say, beyond my teenage years or beyond my youth, to have an experience where I feel just utterly electrified by an image in my mind to the point where you're getting goosebumps, or maybe you have some trepidation about going down a certain hallway or something, where you're absolutely enraptured by the imagination. And it makes me think, what kind of world do we live in where we somehow created a program of extinction for the imagination, where these things don't happen, and that in order for them to happen, we have to have a very sort of intentional intervention with it. And that makes me curious, at any point in your encounter with this material, did you ever start dreaming, or did you find that your own mind was becoming more active? And are there any particular dreams that you have that sort of stand out?
Well, there's a few things here to discuss. So when I was probably about 21, 22, I got very interested in sort of tantric practice and raising the kundalini. And I had to stop because I had such dreadful nightmares of electrocution, these constant night terrors, and where you would have false endings to dreams, a bit like kind of a horror film where you come out of it, but you're still asleep, which is indicative of sleep paralysis. Succubal experiences and things like that and stuff like that. And then I realized, yeah, actually this is serious. This does work. You probably need a guide if you're going to do this. So yeah, I experienced a lot of night terrors when I was exploring occultism. But it's interesting. One of Hillman's earliest books called Pan of the Nightmare, which is exactly about this. So it's a review of a 19th century essay, but he touches on it quite a bit. But no, not so much in adult life, engaging with Hillman, But what I did is I did spend a bit of time looking at exploring the Hillman-esque dream paradigm. And I found that extremely interesting and extremely kind of non-productive in a way. Hillman looks at dreams and says we need to stick with the images rather than sort of interpret them. So a classic image in a dream would be of a snake that you would, through Freudian or Jungian or even Christian, you would read as a phallic or a devil or something like that. And Hillman says, no, what you need to do is stick with the image. The dream belongs to the night world. It's not there as a resource for the day world. So what you want to do is stick with that image. Look at the snake, have a conversation with the snake, feel what it's like, look at its color, look at its texture, and have a sensate relationship with that snake itself. So I started exploring that in dreams. And it was quite interesting the way the material would change. And I briefly mentioned this in the book, where I'm talking about practicing astral travel, active imagination. So one of the exercises is to visualize a symbol on a door and walk through the door. So you have all these processes of like sort of entering this, they're kind of like hypnotic suggestion, just processes of entering this world in a tangible way. And I was saying what tends to happen, and this is based on studies of active imagination and working with Hillman's dream paradigm, is that soon after opening that door, you will find a tree, which is the same material as the door, and you might find a seal on that. So these things happen in a kind of very autonomic way. And I think in your book, I thought it was really interesting about your concept of autocasonic. I think that's a really important concept to actually just trust this autocasonic process that happens when we engage with active imagination.
And he's talking about our book, Anti-Oculus, A Philosophy of Escape, which is out on Repeater now. And for that book, one of my primary contributions was a discussion of the politics of the image. And so we're edging up on this question of politics right now. I guess we should just go right for the gusto here and talk about how, for example, the dream world or the underworld, Hades, as Hillman imagines it, could be a kind of anti-capitalist space. I did a video on this actually for this very channel, where Hillman in Dream in the Underworld, one of his most popular books, talks about the capitalism of the ego. So for example, if you have a dream and then you go to a therapist and you want this dream interpreted, why do you want it interpreted? Well, you want it interpreted for your general wellness, or maybe you want to find out what's going on so that you can enhance your effectivity or the utilitarian dimension of our life. And Hillman thinks that this is an absolutely flawed way to approach the dream world, because images, and the phrase I actually steal from Mark Fisher, and we'll talk about Mark Fisher in a little bit too, but Mark Fisher uses in his dissertation, Flatline Constructs, this concept of entification. And I thought that was such a nice word to map onto the concept of dealing with images in a way as if they were entities, rather than dismissing them as sort of specters of the imagination, just this ephemera that just sublimates off the top of our head on any given day. But what Hillman suggests is, we can involute this ego and we can experience the world in a way where it's alive. It's like an entity, and these images are like entities. And this has implications for the way we treat things like nature, the environment, cities, cultures, our family relationships, our friendships, and so forth. And so I was wondering, and we'll just start with you, Andy, like what do you think in Hillman's work, or just in your own thoughts, makes dreaming potentially against capital in some way?
Okay, yeah. So this is, I mean, I think I heard about it first in an interview that Hillman was, he was talking more generally about kind of child psychology, really, and the way in America people send their kids to a therapist, like they're sending a car to a garage and they want it back when it's fixed. So his kind of concept is therapy is for life and a therapeutic way of living. And obviously that follows from his book, The Dream and the Underworld. So in The Dream in the Underworld, the essential, it's a very strange book, because you come to it expecting to understand the dream from the day world, but what you end up understanding is the hermetic nature of the dream, the very mysterious nature of the dream, and what it's actually serving. But it certainly isn't serving the day world. So Hillman gives a lot of examples of how we tend to use dream interpretation. You know, you're either looking, or should I get out of this relationship, or should I go into that relationship, or I'm anxious about my job, should I change my job? So we're dream interpretation, your family relationships, your parental relationships, all the kind of classic Freudian. But he's saying that, as you said, that's essentially it's capitalizing on these autocasonic processes that are happening when you're asleep. And it's actually quite deluded to think that what is happening in your brain when you're asleep is somehow related to what you're going to do the next day or your life path, because these are very conscious decisions. And what actually is a dream? We've come to this conception that a dream is a kind of neurotic mirror of what's happening in your life. And it isn't at all. The dream, he makes a really fascinating argument. And as he said, he challenges what he calls the dream ego. So when we go into dream, the dream ego wants to take something from that dream. But he says, no, it's the exact opposite. The dream ego needs to go into that dream and let the dream tell itself, really. So he compares, he calls it digestion. He says a dream is a digestion of the day world. So all the material that goes into a dream is digested to create soul, essentially, to create an essence of a kind of internal world. And he makes the analogy between with the Egyptians who'd like put bits of their day world into the tombs and stuff like that. They weren't there to come back out. They were there to travel with you in the underworld. So there's some very interesting things he does in Dream and the Underworld to show classic tropes of dreams and what they seem to be, what's the another reading here. So, for instance, running late in a dream, this concept of retardation in a dream, he says, well, the dream is actually slowing down and existing outside time. And this common sort of thing that we have in dreams, we're late for something, we're late for that something. That's actually the dream world telling you that it's not in time. It exists outside time. So that reading is very hermetic and it's very strange. It ends up in a very cryptic world of hermetic thinking where it can't be resolved. It can't be resolved. All it can be done is to go deeper into this journey, really. And we do it every night. And essentially, they're in a sense, the dream, when we're asleep, we're the closest to death. So they're probably more associated with preparing for death than they are for life.
Yeah. I think potentially one of the upshots for the day world, which, I mean, in the end, I think Hillman is suggesting that our encounter with the night world and a certain comportment towards it can have day world impacts, but not if our approach to it has a day world mindset as we try to grasp these images. But the one sort of overlap, I think, between dream work, at least the way that Hillman envisions it, and what we would call political or historical consciousness, class consciousness, is an attunement to, and Hillman uses this phrase quite a bit from W.H. Auden, we are lived by forces that we pretend to understand. And I think when it comes to understanding, for example, the way that capital works, or the ways that we are subjectivated by the institutions of our world, sometimes it's hard to get our finger on the pulse of those things without really taking a step back. I mean, we have tools, we have philosophy, sociology, and psychology, and so forth. But I think what Hillman is doing is he's going right to the base layer and saying that what underlies even our heuristics and our disciplines is the image itself. And so if we begin to treat these images as entities in a certain way, we get rewarded with an opening of a kind of consciousness. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, and this ties in with the anti-capitalism. So where Hillman breaks with Jung and what really beefed him about Jung was this concept of spiritual inflation. So he was concerned that this, the process of individuation was leading to kind of like a messianic thing where the spirit is inflated. Now, air, inflation, that's all got like capitalistic terminology. Where Hillman brings in the concept of the soul is really interesting, because the soul doesn't seem to have any, it doesn't offer any material gain. You make soul, but you don't get anything back from it. You don't get any material gain from it. So in that sense, it's a very anti-capitalist sort of strategy that what you're going to do and how you're going to live your life in an ensouled world isn't necessarily going to be harmonious with the day world as we know it, and being successful. Ultimately, all these, even magic in a lot of degrees, is this concept of being successful in life and having some sort of material gain. But the way the approach of the soul is almost the exact opposite. It's this kind of work that you do, and the work is to transform yourself inside, and then the outside, you become a reflection, or the outside becomes a reflection of the inside, and the inside becomes a reflection of the out, which is again essentially alchemical sort of transmutation, but it's an internal process. And you're not, it's not, the strange thing about Hillman is he's not going to make you more successful in your career or anything like that. This is where it's quite paradoxical, because, and this is where he gets a lot of criticism, because people say, well, you're not really helping people, are you, in this sense? But you're absolutely right. His concern is bigger here. It's about ensouling the world. If we can ensoul the world, then we wouldn't have to worry about, we wouldn't blame ourselves for everything. And in City and the Soul, it's a good example of the way she looks at, or the way that rather than internalize our depressions and things like that, we can see them symptoms of a world that isn't ensouled. So there's one thing I want to say about this kind of whole idea of acid consciousness, because I was thinking about, I mean, you were Acid Horizon, Mark had acid communism, and I actually spoke to Mark about a year before he died, and I was chatting to him over his place, and I said, oh, of course, acid communism, it's a take on acid fascism, isn't it? You know, those books, there's a book called Mindfuckers, isn't it, that came out in the 70s, it's a classic of acid fascism. Mark hadn't heard, and he said, no, it was nothing to do with that. So I started thinking about the idea of the relationship between acid and soul, and it's quite obvious, because acid is associated with the psychedelic experience, and psychedelia means revealing the soul. So in actual fact, this is interesting that there's this new concept that Mark was developing, and that you're taking on, applying the word acid, but you could equally say that's to do with the soul as well.
Forgive me if I've confused things a bit here. I've been having a conversation with both you and Federico Campagna via email, and both of you knew Mark Fisher, and we've both been talking about acid communism, and I think both of you mentioned either introducing Hillman's work to Mark. Was it you, and forgive me if I've forgotten, was it you or Federico who did that? Did you have a conversation with Mark about James Hillman at some point?
Yeah, I gave him my copy of The Dream in the Underworld.
He
took it with him.
And you didn't have a follow-up conversation on that?
He had it for years.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah, it wasn't sort of tipped him over the edge. But but it was based on a conversation with Mark, because Mark, I'd been talking about Hillman, and he goes, oh, Federico's really interested in Hillman. So I said, read of this. So it was, I'm not sure whether how much he dug into it, because he's obviously so busy on various things. I think he would have connected with it.
Well, I think there's a resonance. You pointed it out before I did. I'm actually writing something right now that's bringing together the work of Hillman and Mark Fisher, because when I read the fragment or the incomplete essay on acid communism, I couldn't help but think of Hillman's work, especially where he notes, for example, theorist Ellen Willis's claim that in order for anything like a revolution to take place, there needs to be a massive shift at the psychic level, that if we proceed with the kind of politics that we envision through, for example, the Marxist paradigm or any number of like anarchist paradigms or whatever, we are bound to repeat some of the same mistakes that we see under nationalist forms of capitalism. And one of the places of overlap between both James Hillman and Mark Fisher is, and we see this particularly in Hillman's work, is the idea that this Promethean mode of expression that we find in the 19th and 20th century imagination has brought about the very horrors that we're trying to combat politically on the left today. And so what Hillman asks us to do is to engender this attitude that undercuts that tendency. And I think we see a bit of that in acid communism too, when we're asked to kind of take a trip, to float upstream, as Mark talks about. But the obvious criticism coming from another portion of the left is that the work of James Hillman, especially having its provenance in something like alchemy or Carl Jung, has this inherent irrationalism built into it. And this is a kind of criticism that we see in the work of Gregory Lukacs, for example, and his attack on Karl Kerenyi, who was an affiliate of Jung. And eventually Lukacs had Kerenyi removed from his position, really for what chalked up to be no good reason other than that he thought his theories and ideas were irrational. I'm curious what you think, because there's a part of me that is hugely sympathetic towards Hillman's idea that if we end up somehow displacing this part of our imagination that is deemed irrational or is deemed out of the realm of the control of the ego, it's going to appear in other places in our world. Whether that's, you know, in a sort of like shadow aspect in the Jungian accent, or it's going to crop up in other places, and it's going to demand that we integrate it somehow. So I'm curious what your take on that is.
Yeah, I mean, irrationality is an interesting topic of like kind of. So it seems entirely irrational that Trump and Biden are running for presidency. That doesn't feel rational to me. You know, so irrationality seems to be quite prevalent in reality. So I'd argue that. And this is a Dadaism came out of the irrationality of the First World War. So it's like almost fighting irrationality with irrationality. But yeah, so I do touch on this a bit in the Astral Geographic, because I was thinking about my career and my life. So I'm a very rational, logical job, and my qualifications are in medical science, and my MSc is in neuroscience. So, I mean, neuroscience is essentially a reductive science in terms of these days looking at everything boiling down to sort of molecular biology and genetics, really. But there's a guy called Patrick McNamara who came up with this idea of decentering, and he sees the ego as a process rather than a thing, and it's a tight loop handled by various areas of the frontal cortex, and they keep this system under control. And the process of decentering, either through kind of meditation or ecstatic dance or drugs, results in this kind of central control mechanism being loosened and people being able to decenter. So there's two modes of thinking. There's associative thinking, which is associated with kind of magical, irrational thinking. I don't think it's entirely irrational. What I would say is it's a mode of thinking formed of association. So you're thinking associatively rather than binary logic or reductive logic. So this process of decentering allows you to escape the kind of world of reductive thinking and inhabit a world of associative thinking. So rather than irrationality, I would say magic and imaginal psychology and things like that are an adoption of associative thinking, which, again, like there's another concept in kind of anthropology of magical thinking. So the traditional idea is that primitive societies, they have customs that are based on magical thinking. But in actual fact, Susan Greenwood in this book says, well, when they interviewed people in tribes, they said, we know perfectly well how to employ reductive thinking. We just don't choose to. So what I would say is that we can have a choice, and we can do it maybe once a week on a Thursday at 7 o'clock in order to invoke Jupiter. So I don't think associative thinking and reductive thinking should be the entirety of your life. You should be able to choose, and the ultimate freedom in life is to be able to choose how you think. But I agree, you can't live life entirely irrationally, because you'd end up in a hospital or dead. So I don't espouse the idea of living life completely irrational, in a completely irrational way, or an associative way, if you think. I prefer the term associative sort of mindset. But you can do it in a ritual context. So ritual is a decision to do it. And then you apply different correspondences to give that. It's almost like, as you say, give it that kick. Give it that kick so that you will form a planetary magic. I actually sort of explore in the book in terms of geography. So you can give it give this kind of experience or this place you want to investigate reality in a kind of laboratory conditions. You can do it through correspondences. So you can do a ritual on a Thursday at 7 o'clock. So in terms of rituals, there's a system there for when you do it to give it heightened significance. Mm.
And this brings us to what I think is one of the important structuring metaphors of Hillman's work, is the idea of a laboratory, the idea of alchemy. Alchemy not as a rational science, but as a practice of the imagination and an ongoing work to create a substance beyond the ego. And this is one thing that talking about the politics of the matter, I think Hillman puts in the politics of the ego in direct contradistinction with the idea of alchemical becomings, that there can be this kind of work on the imagination that transcends the boundaries of how we ordinarily understand ourselves. And this is a big part of your book, The Astral Geographic, and this figure of Fulcanelli, who, despite all of my alchemical predilections, I'd never looked at, and I had to go watch some videos on YouTube and, of course, read your chapter. But this is somebody who's quite interesting and maybe adjacent to the Hillman stuff a little bit. Could you talk about that a little bit? What's happening in the Astral Geographic with alchemy, and should we know about this alchemist Fulcanelli?
Yes, so Fulcanelli was a very interesting character. So he's quite possibly a confabulation of two people, one called Eugène Cancellier and another guy called Jean-Julien Champagne. And this master alchemist was supposedly their teacher, and he delivered this book called The Mystery of Cathedrals around about 1926. And then disappeared. And the book purports to explain the alchemical, or rather suggests that the plaques and engravings around the porch door at Notre Dame Cathedral elucidate the alchemical process, and suggests that the actual masons were alchemists. That's a sort of surface thing, but underlying it is a magical language called the langue verte, the green language, that Fulcanelli uses to expound the theories of alchemy. And it's a really interesting language that's full of puns and also visual doubles. So again, imagistic doubling all the time. But what I discovered, I mean, I've read a lot of Fulcanelli and things like that, and there's a particular window in a church in London that has this carving of a sort of barrel with a arrow through it, and Fulcanelli looks at this as a significant kind of process of like divulging the alchemical language. It's called a rebus, a visual pun. So the prior of this church, St. Bartholomew, was called Bolton. So this kind of image is a visual pun of his name. And that's used throughout heraldry and things like that. So Fulcanelli makes all this connection between kind of language of heraldry and alchemy and things like that. But what's really interesting is that Freud considered the rebus as the kind of as a root sort of process in dreaming. So dreams are pre-literate. So if you think about the brain as it's operating a dream, it's not literate. So when you read a book, you can't read a book in a dream. The words move all over the place and things like that. So you haven't got the capacity to do kind of intellectual activity. So what the brain is doing is it's making visual associations all the time. And these are creating like visual puns and give the internal logic of a dream. So I think that's very interesting, because in a sense, that's quite similar to Hillman's idea. So this Kabbalah that Fulcanelli develops, he calls it, is based on homophones rather than numeric Kabbalah in Hebrew. So words sounding the same. And actually, I was reading Hillman yesterday, and he was talking exactly about the way that puns can, kind of punning language can actually sort of give a kickstart into a different kind of deeper meaning of an image. And obviously, the sort of classic case is James Joyce's work, and particularly Finnegan's Wake, which is a kind of massive sort of pun about the dreaming mind of Finnegan and things like that. So it all ties in very neatly with this kind of idea that there's a kind of language and a kind of almost synesthetic language that's happening when we're dreaming. And I think that's where the Fulcanelli's real value actually is.
And one of the interesting things that I found out about Fulcanelli is that he claims that the alchemists had the key to nuclear power before the scientists did. Is there anything you can tell us about that? That seemed so strange, especially since at the time that Fulcanelli was trending, as we might say today, we were on the eve of discovering nuclear power.
Yeah, I think it was. If you think about theory of relativity, we don't actually have to, you know, we can. That's theoretical. So a lot of the kind of ideas from alchemy were the theoretical, but also the spiritual and also the kind of moral consequences of exploring in a certain way. So I think my feeling is that there was some sort of equivalent of like kind of the what Einstein was doing with kind of visualization, the process of splitting the atom and taking things further and the alchemical process and the dangers of doing that. So I think there's that particular reading in the sense that that's why they were keeping it a secret science, because it could be disastrous. But you know, there's other theories that Fulcanelli was a nuclear physicist as well. So there's a bunch of theories as to who he is. So he might have actually fed into this kind of this nebulous network of people who were Fulcanelli essentially. So, but yeah, it's an interesting idea. But I tend to think it's based on like a almost like a relativist Einstein's sort of ideas of like kind of sort of visualizing physics, but applying it to sort of protochemistry.
As we wind down our discussion here, there's one more thing I want to ask you before you talk about the book. You're reading part of what is called the Uniform Editions, the collected works of James Hillman, the copy called City and Soul, which is probably one of the more political collections of essays, I would say, by Hillman, because what it involves is how do we bring about a restoration of the anima mundi, or a world soul, or what some people call the re-enchantment of the world. And given that here on Zero and Repeater, we talk about politics quite a bit, I was curious if there's any particular ideas that stand out to you in that book, or maybe you can just answer the question, like when it comes to ensouling the world or re-ensouling the world, what are some lessons from James Hillman that you really take to heart?
Yeah, I mean, I think I like the idea that he suggests that the heart of the soul is Aphrodite, that what really animates the soul is beauty and love. And he thinks that if we can engage or rather wake up and realize how much we've been anesthetized to the soul and how much our surroundings anesthetize us. So the word anesthetize obviously is the opposite of aesthesis, you know, the idea of aesthetics. And Hillman's very interested in the idea, the original idea of aesthesis. It was actually a thought of the heart rather than the brain, and a breathing in of the world. I think he says aesthesis means like I breathe in. And he's saying that what would be more politically inciting or revolutionary is if we suddenly awoke to the idea of where's the beauty in the world and how the world has lost beauty. So and that we're anesthetized to it. So he sees revolution as always coming through creative and colorful means and beauty and things like that. Sometimes he paints with a broad brush, but the Berlin Wall came down not because of politics, but because of art and creativity and things like that. And actually, I was in Berlin last week, and what was interesting, I went to the Stasi Museum, and the display outside about it was all fanzines and squat gigs and things like that. So the creativity is essentially revolutionary. But Hillman says it's feeling the love is the essential to it, and actually overcoming the or realizing we've been anesthetized to it. And I just sort of need to look something up here just because I made a note of it, because it actually relates to a couple of things I was reading about. I was looking at Marx's idea of acid communism. And Marx had this idea of depressive hedonism, didn't he? Which is similar to, and I was reading some guy's comment on Marx's depressive hedonism, and he was calling it anesthetic consumption or something like that. So we consume in an anesthetic way, you know, so sort of scrolling through social media is an anesthetic activity as opposed to an aesthetic activity. So my take out at the moment from Hillman's City in the Soul is based on you visiting Berlin last week and things like that, and rereading this particular chapter, is this idea that, as you were saying, that ties in with what Mark was thinking, is that it needs to come from a completely different point of view or different feeling or different engagement with the world, which is essentially convivial and creative and colorful.
Well, that's a phenomenal takeaway from me. I never thought about it in that way, that, for example, the technologies that we're utterly addicted to are anesthetizing. And what that means is it's robbing us of the potential to live a life where through the lens of the aesthetic and to see the beauty in the world. And that is certainly at the heart of Hillman's thought. Before we go, we definitely want to plug your book a little bit more, The Astral Geographic, The Watkins Guide to the Occult. And what, besides alchemy, besides geomancy, besides psychogeography, what is it that book is trying to do? It's almost like a magical itinerary or a travel log of sorts. What kind of readers are going to lock into this book?
English Heretics was a kind of very anarchic sort of psychogeographical sort of subversion of this government quango called English Heretics. Whereas I think I'm playing a straighter bat in Astral Geographic. So I look at, but essentially the concept is to tell the story of magic through geography. How can we, there's lots of ways of discussing the esoteric, different forms of esoteric practice, but this is a particular way of telling that story through location, through landscape and things like that. So everything that's discussed has a cue and a narrative that's based on landscape. So even chapters like on Tantra, I'm particularly looking at the carvings and things and how that story's told, or gardens to tell the story of kind of sort of Masonic thinking and things like that. So that's one part of the book, but the final part is a kind of application of like a sort of mini grimoire that allows you to form sort of planetary magic, and all these things that are really interest me about active imagination and things like that, and ensouling your world, if not everybody else's world. But my great interest is in creative occultism, in magic is a way of increasing your creativity and working with creativity. So I'm not really interested in materialistic gains other than the kind of what it does to my imagination. And that's the second part of the book, by applying like geographic principles for engaging in magical practice. So it's got twofold, really.
Well, Andy, I was very pleased to have been introduced to you by Tarek Goddard and to find a fellow Hillmanian on the other side of the pond. And I hope we can continue this conversation over the weeks, months, and years in case anything Hillman-esque comes up that we need to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a real pleasure. And yeah, as I said, it was really good to see you bringing that into Antiochus. It was it's what I wanted to see for a while, really, to be honest. Yeah. Yeah, I know Federico does it to a certain degree, but it's good that we're exploring that area because it's very dear to my heart, really, to be honest.
Yeah, that's great. And I have Federico tentatively scheduled for an interview sometime in the upcoming weeks and months. So
that's great.
That's exciting. Well, once again, Andy, thank you. Everybody go out, find the English Heretic Collection and find the Astral Geographic, and we'll post links to that in the show notes. And Andy, once again, thank you.
Oh, thank you too, Craig.
We appreciate your support of the imprint and the channel. Subscribe to Zero Books today on Patreon. Your material support helps us to promote a variety of perspectives on the left. Also, discover the many titles, new and old, that Zero has curated. Navigate to any of the links in the show notes to extend your support.